Hey guys, this is episode number 4 of Forensic Tales. I'm your host, Courtney Fretwell, and this week I have a case for you that made national headline news when the story first broke in February 1970. Not only did the case make national headline news for its horrific nature, it was a case that involved the United States Army. Jeffrey McDonald was a decorated U.S. Army officer and physician who was living what would many consider the all-American dream. He had a beautiful wife, 2 young daughters, and a baby boy on the way. He served his family and he served his country. However, Jeffrey McDonald's life would be turned completely upside down one early February morning in 1970, when his entire family was brutally murdered inside their very own home. Was Jeffrey McDonald, a grieving husband, devastated by the loss of his entire family, or was he a stone-cold killer? Only the forensic evidence in the case would decide. This is Not Another Manson Murder. Our story this week has a slightly different beginning than our last episode. In episode number 3, we discuss the case of Gary Ridgway, also known as the Green River Killer. Ridgway's life didn't get started on the best foot. He had a difficult time in school and even more trouble at home. But our story this week begins on a very different note. Jeffrey McDonald was born in Queens, New York on October 12, 1943. He was the second of 3 children and by all accounts grew up in a very loving and stable household. He was raised and attended high school in Long Island, New York. He was even voted, quote, most popular and most likely to succeed by his fellow classmates in high school. McDonald was senior class president and even captain of the high school's football team. So by all accounts, he was really the all-American superstar. Right from birth, it appeared that he had everything going for him. On top of his popularity around campus and his stellar performance on the football field, he was also extremely smart. His grades in high school were so good, in fact, that he actually won a scholarship to Princeton University. Now, of course, I don't personally know the admission requirements for Princeton University, but I do know that his grades and performance in high school must have ranked him somewhere in the top percentile of his entire high school to even have the chance at getting into a university like that. Although Jeffrey was away attending classes at Princeton University, he stayed in a relationship with his high school sweetheart, Colette Catherine Stevenson. Colette Stevenson was born on May 10, 1943 in Manhattan, New York, and attended the same high school as Jeffrey growing up. After dating for several years, Colette and Jeffrey actually found out that they were expecting their first child together in September 1963. After learning the exciting news, the couple decided to get hitched and welcomed their first baby girl, Kimberly McDonald, on April 18, 1964. Later that same year, in 1964, Jeffrey finished his schooling at Princeton University and decided to move his little family to Chicago, where he was accepted to Northwestern University Medical School. While Jeffrey was super busy working and studying his way through medical school, Jeffrey and Colette welcomed their second child into the world, another baby girl born on May 8, 1964, named Kristen McDonald. At this point in their lives, things were going really, really well for the family. Jeffrey was just about to finish medical school, and the couple had 2 beautiful girls to raise together. Jeffrey graduated from medical school in 1968 and went on to complete an internship at the Columbian Presbyterian Medical Center in New York. Shortly after completing the internship, he made the huge life decision and joined the U.S. Army on July 1st, 1969. As is the case with most military families, they didn't have much of a choice where he was going to be training or where he was going to be stationed while in the Army. So the family ended up moving to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. By all accounts, Jeffrey had an extremely successful career in the military. He even held the rank of captain and was assigned to the 6th Special Forces Group as a group surgeon in September 1969. Jeffrey's success in the Army wouldn't last long, though. His entire world would be turned completely upside down one early February morning in 1970. At 3:42 a.m. on February 17, 1970, 911 dispatchers on Fort Bragg's military base received an emergency phone call from Jeffrey McDonald himself. Hysterical, he was barely able to get the words out that there had been a stabbing. Not much else was recorded on the 911 call, so four responding military police officers arrived shortly after the call at 544 Castle Drive. At first, the police officers thought that they were just responding to some type of domestic disturbance in the house. Again, not much was reported on the 911 call, so officers really didn't have much information before going on the call. After arriving at the McDonald residence, police found the front door closed and locked, and the house appeared to be completely dark. It appeared as if no one was even home. It was completely silent. But police didn't just walk away, not yet. They made their way towards the front door of the residence and made several loud knocks on the front door, but got no response. They decided to take a look around the house, so they made their way to the back. This is where officers found the back screen door closed, but the screen door itself was wide open. Suspicious, military police made their way into the house. As they made their way through the dark house, room by room, they were instantly stopped in their tracks. There was a body. Upon entering the McDonald residence, military police quickly encountered Jeffrey's wife, Colette, unresponsive in the master bedroom. After encountering Colette, they immediately checked to see if she was breathing or had any signs of life. There was none. Colette was dead. As police made their way through the rest of the house, they found two additional lifeless bodies. Both Kimberly and Kristen, Jeffrey and Colette's young daughters, were found dead in their respective bedrooms. So all three victims, Colette, Kimberly, and Kristen, all received horrific and violent deaths. Now, I don't want to dive into too much detail about their injuries or cause of death, especially since two of the victims were so young in this case. But it was very clear to first responders that they were brutally attacked. All three victims had severe wounds covering most of their bodies. Right away to police, this appeared to be a savage and brutal attack that they just had to act fast. When police first encountered Colette's body in the master bedroom, two things stuck out to them. One was that Jeffrey's torn pajama top was draped over her chest, as if Jeffrey or someone else tried to cover up a massive wound on her chest. The second thing that shocked first responders was that on the headboard of the bed, the word pig was written in blood. Now, if that sounds familiar, that's because it is. If you remember, Charles Manson and his, quote, family members infamously wrote the word pig in blood at the home of actress Sharon Tate in August 1969. Manson's followers brutally murdered Sharon Tate, her unborn baby, and her house guests just a few months prior to the murders at the McDonald house. Without looking any further into this case, you could probably take one look at the crime scene here and maybe assume that these murders must be related to Charles Manson and his followers. However, as police soon would find out, things aren't always what they seem. Not too far from Colette's body, police discovered Jeffrey McDonald just a few feet away in the master bedroom. The difference, however, was that police quickly realized that Jeffrey was still alive, that he must have somehow survived that savage and brutal attack that claimed his entire family. Jeffrey was quickly rushed to nearby Wamick Hospital, located on the military base just a few miles away. Hospital reports indicate that he was treated for several cuts and bruises on his face and chest, along with a mild concussion. Doctors at the hospital also treated a stab wound on his left torso. I, of course, don't know much about wounds or much about their severity, but it was obvious to doctors and hospital staff that the stab wound was superficial. It was described by doctors as being, quote, a clean, small, sharp incision, end quote. So Jeffrey was treated by the hospital and released about 1 week after his family was brutally attacked and murdered. As soon as Jeffrey was released from the hospital, police had so many questions for him. He was the only one to survive the attack, so of course, police wanted to talk to him and get his account of what happened that morning. So here's what Jeffrey told the police about the attack. According to Jeffrey, on the evening of February 16th, he had fallen asleep on the living room couch because their daughter, Kristen, had wet the bed that Jeffrey and Colette shared. So I guess instead of changing the sheets or whatever, he just decided that he would sleep on the couch that night. Weird, but okay, he did. He then told police investigators that while he was sleeping in the living room, he was awakened by the terrifying sound of Colette and Kimberly screaming at the top of their lungs. Still in a fog, just after being woken up by the sounds of screams, Jeffrey claimed he was attacked by three male intruders, one black and two white, right there in the living room. There was also a fourth intruder, a female, who was described by Jeffrey as a white female with long blonde hair, wearing high-heeled boots with a white floppy hat that covered most of her face. Now, this is all a part of Jeffrey's story to the police, but he said that while the men were attacking him, the female intruder was just standing there, holding a lighted candle, chanting, quote, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs," end quote, over and over again. Next, the three men attacked Jeffrey with a club and an ice pick. And during this struggle, Jeffrey told police that he was able to get his pajama top up over his head to his wrists and then was able to ward off the thrust from the ice pick. I assume since he was outnumbered here, he was eventually knocked unconscious by the assailants. Okay, so that's the story that Jeffrey provided to military police about what happened in the house that night. But police weren't necessarily buying Jeffrey's story. To them, too many parts of his story just seemed off. To the police, Jeffrey didn't appear to be a man devastated by the loss of his entire family, likely due to a crazed group of Manson hippies. Investigators knew that there was much more to this story and that Jeffrey wasn't being 100% honest. Police weren't buying Jeffrey's version of events, largely due to the forensic evidence found in the McDonald house that morning. The Army investigators who studied the physical evidence found that it just didn't support the story told by Jeffrey himself. So let's take a look at some of the forensic evidence in the case. For starters, the living room, where Jeffrey claimed he was confronted and attacked and fought for his dear life, actually showed very little signs of a struggle, even at all. Police reports indicate that basically the coffee table was turned upside down and like one flower pot was broken. Doesn't really seem like some huge life or death struggle took place, as Jeffrey claimed. Okay, number two. And more damning than the lack of damage to the inside of the home, tiny fibers from Jeffrey's torn pajama top were not found in the living room where he told police it was torn. Remember, ice pick? Yeah. So the pajama top fibers were actually found in several key locations throughout the house. Crime scene investigators located fibers underneath Colette's body in the master bedroom and in both Kimberly and Kristen's bedrooms. So unless Jeffrey was literally fighting the attackers with his pajama top off in all three bedrooms of the house, he was lying. And he was lying big time. Number three on the list of forensic evidence. The murder weapons that were used in the murders were found outside the back door of the house. Police found a kitchen knife, an ice pick, and a 3-foot-long piece of lumber, all of which were determined to have come from inside the McDonald house, suggesting that the weapons used in the murders were not brought in to the house, but already existed. Forensic evidence number four. The tips of surgical gloves were found by crime scene investigators beneath the headboard where pig was written in blood. And guess what? The surgical gloves were identical in composition to a supply that Jeffrey personally kept in the kitchen. But the amount of forensic evidence doesn't stop there. Oh no, it gets way worse for Jeffrey McDonald and his version of events. The McDonald family all had different blood types, which at first when I read this story, I didn't really think twice about this. But as I researched it further, it turns out for a family to have all different blood types is extremely unusual, almost non-existent. People describe this as a statistical anomaly. Well, police investigators used this statistical anomaly to theorize what they believed really happened in the house that morning. So let's assume that the McDonald family, Jeffrey, Colette, Kristen, and Kimberly, were the only four people who were bleeding inside the house that morning. Police theorized that a fight broke out in the master bedroom between Jeffrey and Colette that night. What caused the fight? Police don't know. Maybe it was because of the bedwetting incident with one of the girls, or maybe it was something else. Who knows? But the police story suggests that the argument between Jeffrey and Colette quickly escalated and turned physical. According to the police, Colette likely became so angry with Jeffrey that she struck him in the head, resulting in his head wound concussion. Next, police theorize that Jeffrey began beating his wife, likely with a piece of lumber. During the beating, Kimberly, the daughter, may have walked into the master bedroom after hearing her parents fighting and was struck, possibly accidentally, by the piece of lumber. A major reason why police believe this occurred because Kimberly's blood and brain serum were found in the doorway to the master bedroom. Believing Colette was dead, police believe Jeffrey carried his daughter Kimberly back to the bedroom where she was repeatedly attacked. Okay, Now, here's where the blood type comes into play. Police investigators retrieved traces of Kimberly's blood on Jeffrey's pajama top. And remember, Jeffrey specifically told police he took his pajama top off during the struggle in the living room and said that he had not been wearing the top in the girls' bedrooms. At some point, Colette must have regained consciousness because her unique blood type was found on Kristen's bed covers and even on one wall of the bedroom. Police believe this is likely because she attempted to save both her daughters' lives during the attack. Full disclosure here, I'm leaving out certain details about the attacks themselves, as I've done in previous episodes. I'm specifically leaving out details here when it comes to how Kimberly and Kristen were killed, largely due to their young age at the time, and just the overall brutality of their murders. I want to express how just terrible and awful I think all three murders were, and I really can't even begin to think about or even imagine what it must have been like for any of them inside that house that night. The simple fact that the McDonald family had four unique blood types made it super easy for investigators to know exactly where each trace of blood and DNA came from. They were able to easily pinpoint each family member's DNA and where it was found, and most importantly, where it was not found in the house. DNA evidence doesn't lie. People do. Once Colette, Kristen, and Kimberly were all murdered, police believe that Jeffrey tried to cover up his tracks by attempting to blame the murders on Charles Manson and the Manson family. The only problem is that when police investigators were searching the house, they actually found an issue of Esquire magazine in the family living room, which just so happened to have an extensive article on the Manson family murders. Police further theorize that Jeffrey put on a pair of surgical gloves from the kitchen and wrote the word pig on the headboard using Colette's blood. He then laid his pajama top over Colette's body and repeatedly stabbed her in the chest with an ice pick. The very last thing police believe Jeffrey did before calling 911 that night was he inflicted wounds on himself to make it appear that he was attacked along with the rest of his family. Once police studied all of the forensic evidence found in the house and examined the inconsistencies in Jeffrey's story, Army investigators requested an interview with him, and on April 6th, 1970, they got their chance. Jeffrey was adamant about his story to police. He swore to the police officers that he was absolutely innocent, that he could not, that he would not kill his wife and two young daughters. He told police they were absolutely crazy for thinking that he could do something like this. Even when confronted with the physical and forensic evidence of the case, Jeffrey stuck to his story. Less than 1 month later, on May 1st, 1970, the Army officially charged Jeffrey McDonald with the murder of his entire family. Because the murders occurred on a U.S. military base, the case was investigated by the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command, or CID for short. And because Jeffrey McDonald was currently serving in the Army at the time of the murders and at the time of his arrest, he was entitled to an Article 32 hearing. Basically, an Article 32 hearing is a criminal proceeding under the United States Uniform Code of Military Justice that is similar to a preliminary hearing under civilian law. The purpose of an Article 32 hearing is basically to determine if there is enough evidence to proceed in the case. and determine if the defendant is held to answer. So on July 5th, 1970, Jeffrey's Article 32 hearing began and lasted until September of that same year. Jeffrey's defense team initially argued that the CID police did a poor job during their investigation into the murders and basically told the court that police didn't even look into the possibility of other suspects. The police only had their eyes set on Jeffrey as a suspect from the beginning. So we've talked a lot about the forensic evidence that was discovered in the investigation and how the military basically said that the forensic evidence only points to one suspect, and that's Jeffrey McDonald. But Jeffrey's defense team said no, that there was a lot of critical forensic evidence that investigators failed to properly handle. For example, the defense argued that crime scene investigators actually lost key evidence, including the four torn tips of rubber surgical gloves found in the master bedroom. And even a single layer of skin found under one of Colette's fingernails was lost during the investigation. His attorney told the court that, hey, remember that woman Jeffrey told police about? The woman who was chanting in the living room that night while he was being brutally attacked? Well, turns out she's a local drug user who actually admitted to several people that she was involved in the crimes. And even a number of people remember seeing this woman wearing clothes similar to what Jeffrey had described the night of the murders. Jeffrey's defense made a strong argument towards his innocence in the murders. And on October 13th, 1970, Colonel Rock formally issued a report that recommended the charges be formally dismissed against Jeffrey because they were, quote, not true. And he further recommended that civilian authorities investigate Stokely, the woman and local drug user who admitted that she was in fact involved in the murders. In December 1970, Jeffrey was honorably discharged from the Army, and he eventually returned to New York City, where he began working as a doctor. His time in New York City didn't last long, and he decided to move to Long Beach, California in 1971. During this time in Long Beach, California, Jeffrey didn't remain quiet or decide to live a low-profile life. Oh no. He made several media appearances, including becoming a guest on The Dick Cavett Show, where he actually made jokes about the investigation into his family's murders and how focusing on him as the suspect was a complete waste of time. So we haven't talked much about Colette's side of the family or even what they thought about the murders. Initially, Colette's family totally supported Jeffrey, and they could never imagine that he could or would commit these terrible murders. Freddie Kassab, Colette's father, actually testified to Jeffrey's innocence during the Article 32 hearing. However, once Jeffrey started making those TV and media appearances, Colette's family's feelings toward him started to shift. They slowly started to think that Jeffrey might not be as innocent as he once claimed. Jeffrey McDonald began making contradictory and even outlandish claims to Colette's family and the media about the murders. Like one time he told Freddie that he and some army friends actually tracked down, tortured, and murdered one of the alleged killers in the McDonald family murders. But according to Jeffrey, him and his buddies didn't go to the police, that they just decided to, I guess, handle things on their own. Later on, when Jeffrey was questioned about his comments to Colette's father, he denied them and said it was basically a lie and that he only said it to try and put Freddie and the rest of Colette's family at ease with their daughter's murder. Jeffrey's inconsistencies got worse. Freddie Kassab requested a copy of the Article 32 hearing transcript in order to look into different aspects of Jeffrey's story. Freddie noticed several inconsistencies in Jeffrey's testimony, including his claim that he sustained these, like, near life-threatening injuries during the attack. But when Freddie saw Jeffrey just 18 hours after the attack when he was in the hospital, Jeffrey was literally sitting up in bed. He was even eating a meal, and he observed very little bandages or really anything on him to suggest that he was super injured in the attack. Between the inconsistencies in Jeffrey's statement and a closer look at the forensic evidence in the case, Freddie and Colette's entire family was convinced that Jeffrey himself had brutally murdered his entire family. Because the military refused to prosecute Jeffrey based on the Article 32 hearing, Freddie and Colette's family filed a citizen's complaint through the United States Justice Department. Here's where things get super frustrating for the family. Because Jeffrey was serving in the Army at the time the murders were committed, and since he was no longer with the Army, the citizen's complaint was declared moot, or basically subject to debate. Between 1972 and 1974, 2 long years, the case remained in limbo with the U.S. Justice Department. Officials couldn't decide whether or not to proceed prosecuting Jeffrey McDonald for the murders. However, on August 30th, 1974, Freddie and Colette's family presented a citizen's complaint against Jeffrey to a U.S. Chief District Court judge. They basically asked the judge if a grand jury could be assembled to indict him for the murders. The district court judge listened and actually agreed with the family, so he allowed a grand jury to decide whether or not there was enough evidence to prosecute Jeffrey in the case. On January 24, 1975, after just a few hours, the grand jury voted to indict Jeffrey McDonald for the triple homicide. Within hours of the announcement of the grand jury's decision, Jeffrey was arrested in Long Beach, California. However, he wasn't in police custody for very long, because on January 31st, he was freed after posting only a $100,000 bail. Now, if you ask me, $100,000, even in the mid-1970s, is just not enough when we are talking about a man who is suspected of killing his entire family. I think a decision like no bail would be way more appropriate in a case like this. But in this case, Jeffrey was free on bond and pled not guilty to the murders on May 23, 1975. At his arraignment hearing, his attorneys argued that the case should be dismissed due to double jeopardy and the right to a speedy trial. The double jeopardy argument was based on the fact that the U.S. Army already tried prosecuting him for the murders. But the courts ended up rejecting this argument for double jeopardy because military court and civilian court are considered two separate justice systems entirely. And therefore, it really doesn't qualify for double jeopardy. So the long-awaited murder trial for Jeffrey McDonald began on July 16, 1979, in a federal courthouse in Raleigh, North Carolina, over 9 years after the murders. The prosecutor's case really depended on the forensic evidence because Jeffrey adamantly stuck to his story and there were no other eyewitnesses to the murders that could testify during the trial. So the prosecutor called an experienced FBI lab technician and analyst, Paul Stomberg, to take the stand and testify to the forensic evidence. Stomberg testified that Jeffrey McDonald's pajama top had 48 small, smooth ice pick holes through it. The FBI analyst argued that for this to have happened, the pajama top would have to remain stationary. But this is very unlikely if he had wrapped it around his hands to defend himself like he said he did. Stomberg also showed the jury that if the pajama top was folded a certain way, it was possible that the 48 holes could have been made by only 21 thrusts of the ice pick. This is the same exact number of times that Colette had been stabbed, and the stab wounds and marks were in an identical pattern, leaving only one single explanation. The stab wounds found on Colette's body were identical to the stab patterns on Jeffrey's pajama top. Prosecutors believe that Jeffrey placed his pajama top on top of Colette's body before he began stabbing her. He did this to make it appear as though he himself was in a struggle with the intruders. And prosecutors argued that the forensic evidence didn't match the story Jeffrey told the military investigators. Jeffrey's defense team presented their own interpretation of the forensic evidence. His defense team called forensic expert James Thornton to the stand to try and argue the prosecutor's testimony that the pajama top was stationary on Colette's chest. The only problem is that when the defense team tried to demonstrate this in court using a ham, of all things, the act actually appeared to match more of the prosecution's story, not the defense. Jeffrey McDonald's murder trial concluded on August 29th, 1979, when he was convicted on one count of first-degree murder in the death of his daughter, Kristen, and two counts of second-degree murder in the deaths of Colette and Kimberly. Jeffrey was sentenced by a federal judge to life in prison for each murder, and these life sentences were to be conserved consecutively. After the trial concluded, and while in federal prison, Jeffrey McDonald had the audacity to invite author Joe McGinnis to write a book about the case. McGinnis was basically given full access to Jeffrey and the defense in order to write this book. Jeffrey thought that the book was going to be written about his innocence in the murders. However, the book, which is titled Fatal Vision, if you want to check it out, actually portrayed him as being this, quote, narcissistic sociopath, end quote, which is actually a direct quote from the book itself. Well, Jeffrey ended up suing the author in 1987 for what he claimed to be fraud and eventually settled the case outside of court for a reported amount of $325,000. I have no idea what ended up happening with this money even after I tried researching it a little bit more. I sure hope that it ends up in Colette's family or something like that before it ends up in the prison hands of Jeffrey, but whatever. Jeffrey appealed his conviction, and on July 29th, 1980, a panel of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals actually reversed the conviction based on the grounds that it took the government over 9 years to bring him to trial, and this actually violated his Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial. So on August 22nd, 1980, he was once again freed on $100,000 bail. Well, just like before, his time being a free man in society didn't last long. On May 26, 1981, the United States Supreme Court accepted the case and eventually ruled 6-3 that Jeffrey McDonald's rights to a speedy trial had not been violated in this case. So just like before, he was rearrested and sent right back to federal prison to serve his 3 consecutive life sentences. You would think that this would end Jeffrey's attempt for a new trial, but nope. He continued to fight the case and submitted appeal after appeal, each time arguing that his constitutional rights were violated. These appeals and arguments literally went on for years. And by the year 2007, Jeffrey was still appealing the case, not based on his right to a speedy trial, but because he claimed he had new evidence from the woman he claimed to be in the house that night. Stokely, confessing to her mother about the murders on 2 separate occasions. Now, unfortunately, Stokely died at the age of 32, and ultimately the court denied his motion. While incarcerated, Jeffrey McDonald married his 2nd wife, Catherine McDonald, in 2002. He's made several attempts at parole and has been denied by the parole board each and every time. As of 2015, Jeffrey is serving his life sentences at a federal prison in Cumberland, Maryland, where to this day has maintained his innocence in the murders. His next scheduled parole hearing will be in just a few months, depending on when you listen to this episode, in May 2020. The case of Jeffrey McDonald and the murder of his entire family is a remarkable case when it comes to the forensic evidence. The most interesting aspect to me is that this case was largely decided on the stab patterns found on Jeffrey's pajama top. Without forensic science, Jeffrey McDonald may have gotten away with killing his wife and 2 innocent daughters. Without skilled experts in the field of DNA and wound patterns, our criminal justice system may have let a guilty man get away with murder. Forensic Tales is a Rockefeller Audio production. If you want to read more about Jeffrey McDonald's case and how forensic experts examine stab patterns to put him behind bars, check out my website, ForensicTales.com. If you haven't done so already, do your girl a huge favor and subscribe to my show on Apple Podcasts or whichever app you use to listen to Forensic Tales. Subscribing and leaving me a rating with a review really helps me out, and I absolutely cannot do this show without your support. Join me next week where we discuss a case that used both art and forensic science to catch a killer. The suspect remained free from police custody for 18 years until his face was featured on the popular television show America's Most Wanted. Until then, remember, not all stories have happy endings.